just how big a problem is sepsis with regard to mortality.
Making intubation safer.
When should labor be induced?
And the risk of reoperation after a shoulder replacement.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on March 1st, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to turn first to the British Medical Journal Open Access and their research journal, taking a look at labor induction. There's an awful lot of discussion about this with many women when they get to 41 weeks of gestation. Many people feel like that's too long. And so the question is, what should we do? So they took a look at 1,800 plus low-risk women with uncomplicated singleton pregnancies, and they were randomized to either induction, that was half of them, or expectant management until 42 weeks of gestation. And they said, okay, what about perinatal mortality, neonatal morbidity, all the other things that they take a look at after a child is born? And then what happens if we just do the expectant management? And this is the conclusion. It says this study could not show non-inferiority of expectant management compared with induction of labor in uncomplicated pregnancies at 41 weeks. Instead, there was a difference of 1.4% for adverse perinatal outcomes in favor of induction. And so this sort of like backwards way of saying like, wow, maybe it's better to induce than to wait.
This is an issue for about 10% of women who carry the pregnancy up to 42 weeks. As you alluded to, the risk of perinatal death is increased after 42 weeks of pregnancy. Now, the interesting thing about this particular study is they looked at a lot of different outcomes, but the outcome that really seemed to be different was the Apgar score at 5 minutes. And unfortunately, that's not closely associated with longer-term neurologic disability. So I'm not sure that this definitively answers the question about whether it ought to be induction, but it certainly raises the issue that there's not any harm to it. Whether there's any benefit or not, I still think that's up for grabs. But the fact that there doesn't appear to be any increased harm is clear.
Well, I think that, A, it's really good that they're doing these studies in pregnancy, which, of course, has been one of those sacrosanct populations for a really long time. So I'm glad to see that there's some kind of study that's going on with regard to this. The other thing that I think is interesting, at least from my perspective, is that pregnancy, gosh, you really want to get it over with. And so if there's nothing bad about induction at 41 weeks, I think I would go ahead and be induced. In fact, I was.
Well, Elizabeth, maybe later this year we can report on another study that's ongoing. It's a register-based multi-center trial that, again, is going to compare induction at 41 weeks with expectant management. But it's going to look at a number of different risk factors. So I suspect we'll be able to give our listeners more information over the coming year.
Okay. Let's turn to one of yours. Which one? How about the shoulder surgery?
Yeah, Elizabeth, let's talk about that. We know a lot about hip and knee replacements and what the outcome is and what's the likelihood that you may need another surgery. But there really wasn't a lot of data regarding that for shoulder surgery. So these authors looked at over 58,000 elective shoulder replacements over about a 20-year period. They were able to get the data from the hospital episode statistics from the National Health Service in England. And what they discovered was when they looked at the lifetime risk of revision surgery, if you have an elective shoulder replacement, what's the likelihood you're going to need another one? Is that for men 59 years and younger, the risk was 1 in 4. That's pretty substantial. Compare that, for example, to a woman over the age of 85, where the risk needing another surgery is about 1 in 37. Now, most of these shoulders weren't just wearing out because in the younger men that needed to have shoulder revision surgery, it often occurred within the first 5 years after the shoulder was initially put in. This study also looked at other serious adverse events and about 4.5% or 5% risk of having a serious complication in the first 90 days after surgery. So I think this study is important because it helps inform patients about what the risks are, especially age-related, and to allow them to make informed decisions about whether they want to proceed with elective surgery or not.
We neglected to mention which journal is this in?
This is in the British Medical Journal.
And I guess it's worth noting that shoulder surgery, as we've talked about before, and that came as a total surprise to me, turns out to be incredibly common, especially as we age. So this is really a big problem.
And there's been a rapid increase in the incidence of primary shoulder replacements. Part of that's due to the rapid adoption of new implant technologies. Without this kind of data, I think patients can't be informed about whether they ought to proceed with the surgery. Because oftentimes they have pain, usually due to arthritis, and they think, well, I'll just have the shoulder replaced to relieve the pain and I'll be over with this. But this study indicates it may not be quite so simple.
It may be worth a trial of PT.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's turn then back to me. This time we're going to take a look in the JAMA Network Open Journal, looking at this issue of sepsis-associated mortality in U.S. acute care hospitals. This, of course, a very big issue, this idea that somehow we need to prevent sepsis in all of these folks nationally was a U.S. Surgeon General's initiative, what, a year ago or so we talked about it, I think? And the question is, well, okay, how big a problem is it really? So this study took a look at 568 patients who died in the hospital or were discharged to hospice, and sepsis was present in 300 of those hospitalizations and was the immediate cause of death in 198 of those. They took a look at, all right, what else was there? Progressive cancer, heart failure. The most common underlying causes of death in the patients of sepsis were solid cancers, chronic heart disease, hematologic cancers, dementia, and chronic lung disease. And then these hospice qualifying conditions were present on admission in 121 of the 300 sepsis-associated deaths. And so, in this cohort from these six U.S. hospitals, sepsis was the most common immediate cause of death. However, most underlying causes of death were related to severe chronic comorbidities. And I think that's a really important point because I think when we're trying to discern what's going on with regard to sepsis, does sepsis develop because we've got these underlying conditions that really don't have anything to do with sepsis as the proximate cause of death?
Elizabeth, I think you hit the nail on the head, and it is a significant issue because approximately 1.7 million adults in the U.S. each year develop sepsis, and this contributes to about 250,000 deaths. The perception is that most of these sepsis-associated deaths are preventable with better care. And this has obviously sparked numerous sepsis performance improvement initiatives in the hospitals, not only in the U.S., but around the world. But as this study suggests, less than 5% of the sepsis-related deaths were judged definitely or moderately likely preventable. We need further innovations in the prevention and care of underlying conditions that may be necessary before we reduce sepsis-associated deaths.
If sepsis is present at the time of death, but the reason it's there is because of all of these other conditions that have progressed to that point, then to me at least that suggests that trying to prevent sepsis is probably not a terribly practical goal.
Elizabeth, you're right, because the most common comorbid conditions associated with were terminal diseases like cancer and chronic lung disease and chronic heart disease. So your point's very well taken.
Okay, well, let's turn to your last one then.
This is in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it talks about making intubation safer. This is in critically ill adults. Intubation, or putting a breathing tube in individuals, is obviously meant to put them on a respirator to get them through this critically ill period. And the most common complication associated with the intubation is actually low oxygen or hypoxemia. Now, you say, well, why would that be? Because we're trying to improve the respiratory status of the patient. Well, before you intubate the patient, you give them medications to actually induce them and to paralyze it to make it safer. Now, when you do that, you administer those medications. They take about 60 seconds to work. And during that time, the patient can have a low oxygen saturation because they're not breathing. The question is, can you make intubation safer by putting a bag mask on them and manually ventilating them? People have been reticent to do that because of concerns that that will actually cause people to aspirate, that is, forcing air into the lungs and also into the GI tract will cause these patients to actually aspirate to make things worse. So to study this, the authors looked at 401 patients that were enrolled in 7 intensive care units in the United States. They were randomly assigned to undergo routine intubation with the medications I mentioned, or to have the medications and then have the bag mask ventilation just before the patients were intubated. And what they found out was the patients that had the bag mask ventilation as a part of the procedure were half as likely to develop severe hypoxemia. And by the way, they were not any more likely to have aspiration. So this is an excellent study that shows among critically ill adults undergoing tracheal intubation, giving bag mask ventilation prevents hypoxemia and does not increase the serious side effect of aspiration.
Right, which of course is often pneumonia. So that is an important thing to try to avoid. I thought was really interesting in the editorial where they said, isn't it great to take a look at these sacred cows, these things that have been instituted and practiced for a long time and really develop the evidence base?
Yep. And because more than 1.5 million patients undergo tracheal intubation each year in the United States, it's a big issue. And you said the dogma was, oh, don't do the bag mask ventilation because they'll aspirate, it'll make things worse. And then somebody scratching their head said, well, that's interesting, but nobody's ever really looked at it. And let's look at it in a thorough and rigorous way. That's exactly what this study did.
Let's talk about the technical feasibility of this, because I'm not sure I've ever actually witnessed it. Is it hard to do?
It's actually very easy. I mean, the patients get the same medications to get them ready for the elective intubation. But during the time period from when they get that to when the intubation is started, basically just put a mask on, you ventilate them until they're fully relaxed, they're fully paralyzed, then you intubate them. So this is very easy to do.
On that good news note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices. Thank you.